Now, we are joined in our studio by the Fianna Fáil leader and Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, for the latest in our series of party leader interviews. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for coming in to talk to us today. Can I just, before we begin the interview proper, get your reaction to what you've heard there about the resignation from the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party of Senator Martin Conway?
Yeah, I'm very surprised at what has transpired. I heard this morning. I would have known Senator Martin Conway. He was nominated by, I think, Vision Ireland due to visual impairment and it clearly is a very, very difficult moment for him on a personal level. And I don't know the background to the circumstances of his arrest due to intoxication, as he said himself, too much alcohol with sleeping tablets. But as he said himself, he's left himself down. It's very challenging for his family. And I think he needs time now to, on a personal level, endeavour to rebuild his life and maybe deal with perhaps the issues that led to that arrest.
All right, I want to move on. I want to take you back to March 2011 and a speech you gave in the Dáil about Michael Lowry after the publication of the Moriarty Tribunal report, which made damning findings against him. You described him at the time as a rogue politician. You quoted from the report that he had engaged in a cynical and venal abuse of office. You noted that he attempted to influence the arrangement, an arrangement which was profoundly corrupt to a degree which was nothing short of breathtaking. And you said you believed the findings against him, and you said that he should resign from the Dáil. Why did you do a deal to form a government with somebody who you thought at the time was so discredited that he should quit politics?
Well, first of all, I did a deal, and we did a deal, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael Party, and negotiated a deal with the regional independent group that is made up of 7 Dáil deputies, including Michael Lowry. They nominated him to represent them, along with Marion Harkin and Sean Kenny, in the actual negotiations around the policy platform and the programme for government. And then we negotiated with Michael Healy-Ray and Danny Healy-Ray as well. And you had Noel Grealish.
Michael Lowry was there, and he was front and centre there. Yeah. Why did you do a deal with him when you made those comments calling for his resignation, describing him as a rogue politician?
Well, I was just getting to that, but I just want to make the point. It's not just with Michael Lowry, and that keeps getting asserted. And that, in many ways, has clouded a broader consideration of the issues that caused all the row in the Dáil when it first met. You had Gillian O'Toole, Kevin Boxamore, and you have Barry Heenahan as well. And they're deputies in their own right, and they cannot be ignored. It's the regional independent group we negotiated with. Why? Because they were the only group that came forward with an interest in helping to get a government majority. The Labour Party didn't have the capacity to enter government. They were split down the middle. Ivana Bacic said to me that the numbers were against them in terms of they wouldn't have leverage in a government, is what the Labour Party's position was. The Social Democrats were not interested in government formation either. And the Independent Ireland group were, but some of their policy positions, particularly on climate, were not acceptable to Fianna Fáil or indeed Fine Gael.
Do you still believe the things you said back then, including that Michael Lowry engaged in profoundly corrupt activity and that he was a rogue politician?
I believe in the findings of the Moriarty Tribunal, and I don't resile from anything I've said in relation to that. But I would also point out that back in 2016, Michael Lowry would have supported the nomination of then-Taoiseach Enda Kenny, because independents were required for the formation of that government, because Fianna Fáil agreed a confidence and supply, but we abstained on the election of Taoiseach, even though we negotiated a programme for government on that occasion. We had an influence on the programme for government.
You said these things in the Dáil in 2011. I mean, do you not see that people might be cynical about politics when they see that you said those things, but then that you do something which entirely contradicts that position?
If you put it in that way, one can see that. But of course, the fundamental obligation of a Dáil is to elect a government. Anyone I have spoken to have not pointed in any direction to me any alternative other than forming a government with the regional independent group. And that's the bottom line, Justin. And there is an obligation on Dáil Éireann to form a government. That's the fundamental.
So the political necessity overrides everything else.
Well, it's a constitutional necessity, actually, unless we're going to have general elections every 6 months. It's a constitutional necessity to form a government. That is why we have general elections. And Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, relatively speaking, in a fragmented political environment, did well. We were short of a majority. If I'd been consistent about anything over the last time, or during my time as leader at Fianna Fáil, it's been about the importance of governments that last the full term. Mm. I did enter into a confidence supply agreement during Brexit, which stood the country in good stead.
You've just said there, though, that you don't resile from anything you said back in 2011. Yeah. And yet you still were prepared to do a deal with Michael Lowry, who says he enjoys your confidence. Does he?
Yeah, the Regional Independent Group, of which he was the convener, I think have behaved in an upfront way with us. And particularly, it was focused on policy. With a view then to ensure that we can form a government that would have a majority that could last 5 years.
Okay, but Michael Lowry is a member of that group. Do you think now that he has changed, that he's an honourable politician?
I think
now?
there's issues, as we know, in terms of the legal process, which I can comment on or entered into, but particularly in terms of, just to make the point, of the last number of Dáils, he has supported governments, different governments of different hues and colours over a number of Dáils now at this stage, and has been upfront in relation to that, and hasn't deviated from the policy platforms, or indeed in supporting various governments from Endicenny onwards.
Is he honourable?
Well, he's been honourable in his engagements with us, certainly.
Okay. Three of the TDs who said they were supporting the government have now written to the Ceann Comhairle and said that their support is on a case by case basis. What's that all about?
Well, again, there's been a huge row around the rights of independence. And just as you've introduced the conversation through the personality of Michael Lowry, that whole debate has been coloured by that. And I think people have lost the more fundamental points. I think groups have a right to form within Dáil Éireann. I think it's a very fundamental right. There has never been a definition of opposition, actually, in any standing order. And in many ways, I think it's a great pity that people didn't stand back and use the Dáil Reform Committee as a basis to try and resolve those issues.
So those
I'm
three
not worried
TDs,
about those.
You're not worried.
I think fundamentally we've negotiated with the Regional Independent Group and with Michael Healy-Ray and Danny Healy-Ray. I think that gives us a significant majority. The majorities over the last 2 weeks have been significant in terms of the various votes that we have had. And we will work with those independents and indeed with others.
Are you discounting
Matthew McGrath
and
Karen Nolan has met us also. On various issues, and we will work with people in Dáil Éireann on policies. We'll work with the opposition parties as well in terms of any issues that they may have, any ideas or solutions to particular problems and challenges.
As you mentioned, Matty McGrath, do you want him back in your party?
No, that hasn't arisen at all.
Okay.
I saw that headline, but that didn't transpire. No discussions at all on that.
One of the first things you did as Taoiseach was appoint additional junior ministers and gave them extra expenses. If you had told people you were going to do that before the election, do you think it would have been well received?
Well, I think first of all, in terms of the additionality of ministers, migration, older people and marine. We do need a minister of state for the marine. We need a minister of state for older people because demographically the country is ageing, and there's a whole range of policies that have to be brought into place, from housing to health to transport and so forth. And likewise on migration, it's a huge issue. And of course the senior minister in justice, where migration will move to, and that minister of state will have an enormous challenge ahead of them. I mean, one could make the case ultimately in the long term around expanding government from a constitutional perspective, but we are limited. And the problem and the challenge is our population is much greater than when the 1937 constitution was passed. Dáil Éireann itself now has increased in numbers very significantly for this general election. And I think there is merit and value in what we have done.
And you have appointed four super junior ministers who will sit at the cabinet table. And we know there is a legal challenge to that position. You said in the Dáil during the week that you believe that the rule of limiting cabinet ministers to 15 is out of date. If you think that, why don't you put your case to the people and hold a referendum?
Because I think that may very well happen in the future, not with this government. It's not in the programme for government. But I do think broader society and the Oireachtas as a whole do actually need to consider that. If you look back when the 37 constitution was passed, We weren't debating climate change. We weren't debating sort of the huge energy transformation that is occurring right now. There would have been defence and security issues back then, but they're now growing in terms of whole of society and whole of economy security issues, not just military and defence spending alone. It relates to energy, economic infrastructure, and so on like that. And the whole area of the marine is much larger now than it would have been then in terms of policy considerations. So, and then you have the whole area of artificial intelligence coming for. So the areas are enormous that are coming our way. If you look at the climate, environment, energy and transport, two departments under one minister, that's enormous. We're about to enter into a transformation of our energy infrastructure to offshore wind. And we're developing all these new areas, or trying to develop all those new areas, with what I would consider to be an outdated constitutional framework.
And is that spancelling the work of government then?
Well, I think it's reducing the flexibility of the Oireachtas and government to respond. That would be my view on that. Whereas, look at the whole area of children, for example. That would not historically have been a department in its own right. It now is. We've moved disability and children together now. We've taken out areas to enable a focus on disability issues, a whole of government focus there, and on children and child poverty.
Was gender balance not a priority when it came to forming a government?
Well, it was. Let me just answer the question. I mean, we ran the highest number of female TDs of any party. We were extremely unlucky. And we were unlucky. I can name 10 candidates who were very unlucky. People like Fionnuala O'Loughlin and so on.
Don't name
them. I won't. But it would be no harm if others did acknowledge it from time to time, Justin, in the media. No one has acknowledged it yet in this debate. How close a lot of those Fianna Fáil TDs came to get elected. Deirdre Heaney being another. So I just make that point.
And in terms of promotion,
I had 7 TDs then. I decided on this occasion not to appoint any male or female who was first time in Dáil Éireann. Mary Butler I appointed as chief whip because I believe that position is crucial in terms of it's the engine room of government. She's the key person with the Attorney General in terms of driving forward legislation, and I want legislation driven forward. She's tenacious, she's an extremely hard worker. She was the right person for that job.
It was the first time TDs you decided not to appoint, and which limited the number of women you were going to appoint.
No, of the 7, 4 are ministers. Okay, and of the 6 senators I nominated on Friday, 5 of the 6 are women, and I will continue to do what I can to advance the role of women within politics and to give opportunities for women in politics.
You told people before the election that the government was on track to build 40,000 houses. We now know that that was not true, that that was false information, and that the true number, according to the CSO, was 30,300, which is actually lower than the 2023 figure. Why did you give people false information about your housing figures before the election?
Well, we didn't give false information in any in that manner, as you have articulated. I mean, that was a genuine belief at the time. There was a number of bodies, EY Construct, Euroconstruct, for example, Cairns Homes, and indeed others who were predicting close to 40,000. The problem and challenge has been, in previous years, numbers were underestimated, even by the Central Bank and the ESRI and others. In other words, we exceeded not just the Housing for All targets in 2022 and 2023, but also would have exceeded estimates at the close of those particular years. And the figures are published in the first quarter. It is extremely disappointing that the figures were so low in 2024. If you take Housing for All in its totality, we exceeded targets by close to 5,000. Unfortunately, the decline and the drop in 2024, very disappointing. We got that wrong, and I acknowledge that, and I regret that.
You did, but you had the choice of looking at the figures which were being presented by the likes of the Central Bank and by the CSO, both which were tracking the housing numbers accurately. And you chose to rely on the most optimistic figure presented by private industry rather than relying on official government sources.
If you look at figures entering the third quarter in 2023 and 2022, our estimates, People would have said the same thing. That we were told repeatedly the final quarter will be much stronger. We were told that in 2023, and that's what transpired. We were told that in 2022, that is what transpired. It didn't transpire in 2024. And I would make the point, that was not the core issue of the election campaign, by the way. The core issue of the election campaign was who was going to manage the economy properly, but also who had the most credible policy on housing.
Yeah, but
in respect,
but perhaps that was because you were giving a figure which was completely inflated.
No, I mean the bottom,
and people believe that to be true.
No, the bottom line was Sinn Féin put forward a policy in terms of getting rid of the Land Development Agency, about getting rid of first-time supports for first-time buyers, and also coming up with a convoluted affordable housing scheme around.
Okay,
you can own the
home.
No, it's important.
But you have to account for what you did, which was you gave inaccurate. False information to people before the election.
I just want to make the point but I'm making the point in retort to you that was not the core issue in the election campaign. The core issue was, because everybody agreed on 50,000 per annum for the next 5 years, which was the ESRI estimate of what we need. The issue before the election is how do we get there? The Sinn Féin programme did not persuade people. The Labour Party programme did not persuade people. They put forward a national construction agency, housing construction agency, not fleshed out, no detail. That was the fundamental question on housing. Who did people believe had a more credible programme? And people are sceptical generally of the political system in terms of its capacity to deliver housing.
The credibility of your own programme has been seriously undermined now by the real figures, the real housing figures that were published by the CSO, which show that the housing completions last year were just over 30,000 when you'd been promising 40,000 before the election. What I want to know is, who is responsible for providing that false information? Because the Taoiseach, Simon Harris, said he was given that figure by the housing minister.
Well, first of all, the last government exceeded the housing for all targets. That needs to be acknowledged on balance grounds, Justin. It doesn't get acknowledged. We exceeded the housing for all targets. Secondly, in good faith, I think the then Minister for Housing and others pointed to what Euroconstruct and others were saying in terms of coming close to 40,000. It was not in any way a premeditated attempt to mislead anybody. There was a genuine belief that figures would come in strong in the last quarter. That did not materialise. Very disappointed with that. We regret that. And the estimates were wrong, clearly.
And we have the consultants, Mitchell McDermott, saying that only around 32,000 homes will be built this year. Is that what you would expect to happen?
Well, again, I've met with a number of departments in the last week, particularly on housing and with public expenditure, to have a fundamental review of housing policy more generally, particularly in terms of incentivising the private sector, because what's emerging is that the private sector rental area is deteriorating
I do want to ask you about that, but what I want to know today is, do you have a projection for housing completions for
January? No, you've just spent the last 10 to 15 minutes giving out about estimates, so I'm not going to go into that business but obviously we will make an assessment of that in due course. The more fundamental point is, how can we get more houses built faster? And it's clear to me from the discussions I've had with various government departments and officials in respect of the housing question that we need to pivot more strongly to getting private sector investment into the market, because the government is spending huge amounts of money on housing, record levels. The state can't do it all on its own. And we have to be honest about that. Not just this government, but the Oireachtas more generally.
And is that going to have to require some politically unpalatable decisions, perhaps like ending rent pressure zones?
I believe it will entail politically very difficult decisions. We will be guided by some of the work that the Housing Commission did in respect of the rental market. And we have to create a stable environment for investment to flow into the construction area in terms of building private sector units, particularly on the apartment side. And also we have to rezone more land, and in terms of the national planning framework, which we have, I've also had discussions in relation to that. And the government will consider that at the next Cabinet Committee on Housing. That's a very key issue.
Rent sector, is it your view then that caps on rent or rent pressure zones, that they are a problem?
Well, what the Housing Commission has described as the reactionary approach to the rental market has been a huge problem in terms of there's no security of environment for investors. They don't know whether it'll change from year to year. That has to stop and that has to change. The Commission talks about reference rents and so on like that system. We will look at that. We'll examine it. It will take an awful lot more detailed examination, but we are going to look at it. That's not necessarily a crude change in terms of rent pressure zones, but it would be a change, but we have to examine it.
Okay.
And so we're prepared to do that.
You are looking at changes to the way, to the way the rent...
Well, we've got time because obviously
structured.
The rent pressure zones expire at the end of the year. So we have time in between to say, can we develop an alternative system which protects renters, but also enables people to have a clear, stable environment in which to invest.
Okay, but don't investors need to know that they're going to get more return than they currently do for their money? So ultimately, do rents have to rise in order to get more private money
into
the sector?
Well, I think what's been said to me is that what people require more than anything is a stability around the environment that governs investment, that it won't start changing from year to year for political reasons.
All right. I want to ask you about the government's response to Storm Éowyn. 2,000 homes and businesses still without power today, more than 2 weeks on. On the day that the ESB announced that people would likely be without power for the next 2 weeks, you were in Poland, the Taoiseach was in Brussels and the Dáil was on holidays for 2 weeks. Where was the leadership?
The Dáil was not on holidays for 2 weeks. The Dáil was not attending for 1 week, Justin.
Okay.
I'm glad I've had the opportunity to correct something that has been on every RTE bulletin for 2 weeks. The Dáil didn't meet for 1 week. I think if we had recalled the Dáil in the middle of the storm, it would have been a wrong decision. In the middle of a storm like Storm Éowyn, we should be focusing on the frontline responders, giving the agencies every resource they possibly can. Now, I went to Auschwitz. That's where I was on the Monday, in terms of the commemoration of the horrors of Auschwitz. I think it was important for Ireland to be represented there, given a lot of false accusations about anti-Semitism in Ireland and so forth. The Holocaust was an appalling, as we know, atrocity committed against the Jewish people worldwide. It was important for Ireland to be there. I was actually very anxious that government talks would be completed to enable me to attend the Auschwitz ceremony, particularly when there are fewer and fewer survivors of that horror alive.
No, okay, and so no. That was a priority for you.
That did not mean that we were somehow not engaged in the storm. We were. And I had to say 3,000 crew members from the ESB and others were involved and have done heroic work in what was the worst storm we have ever experienced in terms of ferocity and in terms of the number of people outage.
And do you accept, though, that the response was not adequate in terms of the speed at setting up community hubs, at putting the adequate responses in place for people to have shelter, food and somewhere to charge their phones and crucially, for generators to be brought where they were needed to get water?
Yeah, first of all, 768,000 people lost electricity and power because of this storm. And if you compare it to Storm Dara, Ophelia and others, there is no comparison in terms of the ferocity. I think the ESB responded very strongly. And I think I want to say that. And all of the crews and all of those who came from overseas in the European Union to help us. In terms of water, no question, in my view, there should have been stronger generator capacity or in terms of the various plants ready for generator, that the plants would be made ready for generators to come, because it's not as simple as just putting a generator at the disposal of a particular pumping station plant or wastewater treatment. And I've met with Irish Water last week. I'm evaluating the storm very quickly, and I've said to all of them, we have to really act now to fundamentally make our systems more resilient. On the hubs, yes, some of them started up too late, although there have been very good examples. And so the investment in recent times in local networks has proved its dividends. Even in sporting facilities, clubs did outstanding work. We have to institutionalise that. And by that I mean to identify clear focal points for communities who are without power and without water to enable backup generators to go to those community facilities that would be ready on and hand immediately once the storm has abated. I want to say one final thing as well, if not final, but The fundamental objective in the preparation for this storm and endeavor was to prevent loss of life. Unfortunately, there was one fatality. A young man lost his life in Donegal. The red alert system that did work. We will review that too.
Okay.
And it's been extremely distressing for an awful lot of people to be without power and water for so long. I get that. And I think what has to happen, issues like forestry corridors have to be created.
Okay.
And I've already ordered that and instructed that with Tánaiste, and I have said to all of the agencies, be it Cuilte, be it private landowners, and DSB networks, we want forestry corridors by next winter,
right,
and we want to get down to that work. And then we need to institutionalise a setting up of community hubs to make sure there's a proper, comprehensive community local response to people who are in jeopardy or in danger.
On the subject of energy, will there be energy credits this year for people?
We're not going to have a cost of living package this year. That's the government view. We will endeavour through the budget to through the various mechanisms we have, from social protection to tax, to help people. But inflation has come a way down.
Well, people in should know no energy credits in the winter of
We don't anticipate that at this stage.
Yeah. All right. Have you been invited to the White House to meet with President Trump for St. Patrick's Day this year?
Not yet. But again, there's no anticipation of anything different from previous years.
It's your expectation that yep, invite yep, will come. Yep. The leader of the Labour Party, Ivana Bacik, has said that you should consider not going this year in light of some of the things that Donald Trump has said, in particular about removing people from Gaza and forcing them to live elsewhere. What do you say to her?
I was surprised when I heard that from Ivana. I think it's the Labour Party seemed to be moving to a more reckless and irresponsible position in the opposition benches. I have a broader duty as Taoiseach to protect the economy, to protect people's livelihoods in this country. The relationship with the United States is not about any one president, by the way. It's been a long-standing one. It's older than this state itself. It's fraternal. The economic relationship is powerful, powerful relationship, which we cannot ignore. And then there's cultural and strong family connections as well. So I will, of course, respond positively to an invitation from President Trump. We have worked with President Trump in the past in a constructive way. He is legitimately and democratically elected by the American people. That is the reality. I don't intend to undermine the country by gestures of the kind that Ivana has suggested.
Okay. If you do meet him, though, do you intend to speak up for Palestinians in the White House? Do you intend to express directly to him your opposition to his proposal in relation to Gaza and your opposition, your stated opposition, the government's stated opposition to his decision to sanction the International Criminal Court? Will you speak about him directly to him about
those issues? Yeah, we have no issue. There's never an issue with discussing any of those issues and articulating Ireland's position, particularly in terms of support for a two-state solution, and indeed in terms of confirming the second stage of this ceasefire in Gaza, which is absolutely critical and of immediate importance to millions of Palestinians right now.
Will you be raising those issues?
Yeah, we'll be raising a range of issues, including those issues. But I just want to make the point more generally. Ireland has a strong record in supporting Palestinians' right to a homeland, more than most. And if you talk to the Palestinian Authority or if you talk to Arab countries, they will all speak highly of Ireland's principled stand and consistent stand on these matters, and also the upholding of international humanitarian law. We have a perspective on these issues. We've never been slow in any international fora to articulate those.
Has the situation changed in relation to the Occupied Territories Bill, given that President Trump is in the White House and that there is a ceasefire in Gaza? I mean, is it counter to Ireland's economic interests to pass that bill now, considering the close relationship between the United States and Israel?
Well, the government is progressing that legislation. It was very clear that it needed root and branch reform and amendment, and that those amendments are coming forward within the Department of Foreign Affairs, who have been examining the legislation. I think it should be fully debated in the House when the bill gets published. And I think all of those issues in terms of its impact in the Palestinian territories itself.
And what about the impact on Ireland's relationship with the United States? Should that be taken into account?
Well, it is. It's a factor that should be taken into account and should be debated. This is the point I'm making. That's why there should be second stage debates, why I would have favoured a new bill as opposed to just the existing one and bringing it to committee. There are broader issues that do need to be debated in respect of that particular legislation, just like all other pieces of legislation are debated at second stage and so forth.
Do you expect that Donald Trump will levy tariffs on the European Union, including Ireland?
There was an expectation, although there will be engagement between the European Commission and the United States and President Trump. It's the largest economic relationship in the world, the one between the European Union and the United States. Ireland has a huge component part of that. We have some very large companies in the United States creating a lot of jobs. Ryanair, for example, Glanbia, Ryanair buying a lot of Boeing, Glanbia.
Tariffs would hurt Ireland a lot, though.
They would. Tariffs would hurt us because we're a small open economy that depends on exports. We export over 90-odd% of what we produce. We've been strongly supportive of free trade. And if I meet President Trump, I will be saying these things, that, you know, I think free trade has created the largest era of rising prosperity in the world, actually, over decades. And so I'm a proponent of free trade. It's been, notwithstanding the fact that many in Ard Fhéidhl are against free trade agreements, you know, the Canadian-European Union being one.
Is there anything you can do to stop him?
I think engagement and dialogue. It's interesting. Look, President Trump has been elected. There are clear issues in the American political system that arose during the election and during the campaign. Prior to President Trump coming to office, President Biden would have introduced a lot of protectionist measures as well, even during the COVID-19 and vaccination production and so on. We saw that, but also the IRA Act, the CHIPS Act, for example, which is really creating subsidies for in terms of chip manufacturing, and likewise European CHIP Act. So there's been a growing trend in the last number of years towards protectionism, which Ireland feels will be damaging overall in terms of our economic well-being. And so, yes, I think what we need to do, a number of things. We need to strengthen the single market in Europe, expand the single market in Europe, and we'll be pushing for that within the European Union. But also then we'll be working and engaging to try and get a reasonable resolution of legitimate issues that the United States may have to put on the table. And I think Europe is preparing for that.
You'll attend the Munich Security Conference with other world leaders later this week. Right now we have no radar. We've no capacity to defend our skies. We can't properly protect our undersea cables, which are vital to our economy. You said in Cork on Friday that defence, military and security capability is an issue that we can no longer shy away from. What's going to happen?
Well, first of all, I think we will continue to increase investment in our defence and military capability. We have already secured two C-295 aircrafts, which give us far greater surveillance of our maritime zone.
At the moment, if there is a threat in our skies, we're reliant on the RAF to deal with that. Do we need our own interceptor jets or fighter jets?
Well, I think we're a military neutral country and so on. We don't have military capability in disguise. But let's take it one step at a time.
Do we need to?
Well, that's some distance away, Justin. I mean, we've just had a commission on the Defence Forces 2 to 3 years ago. Primary radar is the first procurement process that I've already signed off on when I was formerly Minister for Defence. Greater capacity in terms of strategic airlift is happening, strengthening of our naval capacity, but also cyber security and subsea cables, which is not just all about ships and planes, but is more fundamental in terms of expertise. And that's why the National Cyber Centre will be moving into the Department of Justice in that security area, for example. I mean, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the world has changed dramatically. The incidence and frequency of cyber attacks across Europe has increased dramatically since that war. We've experienced it here through the HSE, through universities, through the private sector being attacked on an ongoing basis. So we really have to strengthen our resilience. And that's why we're part of European Union Common Security Defence. That's why we're involved in more PESCO projects now, which is cooperation projects
with
EU member states on those specific issues of cybersecurity, maritime, subsea, cable security.
Do you think we can continue to remain neutral into the long term?
We can continue to remain militarily neutral, which means we're not members of NATO. Although we do cooperate with NATO, we just recently agreed an individually tailored plan with NATO, again focusing on cyber security and subsea cables. And also we have to focus on our energy security also, because essentially what I'm focusing on here is our economic infrastructure is at risk if we don't strengthen our security capabilities across the spectrum And security must be seen in a much broader way now than just defence forces alone. And technology is becoming increasingly a theatre where security can be.
And when you say our energy security, are you talking then about that perhaps we should build the LNG terminal in Kerry?
We will have to have an LNG facility of some kind. In the last year, the Department of Energy were looking at a floating LNG facility. We will be looking at that, and government will be progressing that. One of my earlier meetings was to focus on that issue, and I met with the Secretary General of the Department of Energy to focus and officials on that very issue, because there is an issue there from a security perspective. Our economy depends on energy security.
Before I let you go, will Fianna Fáil be running a presidential candidate in the election this year?
We've made no decision in relation to that yet.
What's your view?
We'll assess it in due course. I don't want to preempt discussions with my colleagues in the parliamentary party on that, and I will have discussions, but you'll appreciate the focus has been on the formation of government.
It has.
With all of the issues that you've raised, I haven't got around to focusing on the presidency just yet.
If your predecessor Bertie Ahern expressed an interest, would you entertain it?
Well, I'm not going to preempt any personalities or any issues around that. I'm going to discuss it with my colleagues in the parliamentary party.
All right, well, we will leave it there. Taoiseach and Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin, thank you very much for coming in to speak with us.
Thank you very much indeed, Justin.
Thank you.
Yeah.